Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Many of us know North Carolina, one of North Carolina's best and most highly regarded writers. Robert Morgan is the author of the best-selling New York Times bestseller Gap Creek, an Oprah Book Club selection. More recently, Brave Enemies, a wonderful novel about the American Revolution. And now, shortly, we're going to be able to see Robert Morgan in a different light, rather than as a fiction writer or as a poet or as a teacher of writing. His new biography of Daniel Boone is before us soon. And I want to talk to him a little bit today about Daniel Boone. But first, Robert Morgan, I'd like to talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
Welcome. You're a North Carolinian, but you're not in North Carolina right now.
Well, I have been teaching at Cornell University since 1971.
Wow.
But I go back home a lot, and my mother still lives in the house where I grew up, so I go to see her several times a year.
Well, tell us a little bit. Here's my thesis, and whether it's right or wrong, this is sort of the basis that I'm going forward on, is that there were a few, parallels might not be the right word, but that there are a few things about your growing up that might have overlapped a little bit and given you a little bit of insight into Daniel Boone's growing up. Don't argue that point with me, and just tell what was your growing up in the mountains of North Carolina like?
Well, I grew up on a little farm south of Hendersonville in the Green River Valley, and when I was young, we still did subsistence farming pretty much. We didn't have a tractor or truck or car. We plowed the fields with a horse and gathered corn in a wagon and kept our milk and butter in the spring house. So I feel as though I almost grew up in the 19th century to some extent. I tell students I have one foot in the 19th century and one in the 21st. but, of course, that area began to change pretty rapidly in the mid-1950s as industry started moving in and a lot of tourism and retirees and that sort of thing.
Well,
I actually went off to college when I was 16 in 1961, and by then it had changed quite a bit. But I do feel that I have a kind of contact with the frontier world and with the past, partly because I grew up in that area, and it was before television, so we used to hear lots of stories from my dad and my grandpa and my mother about the old days, about the pioneers, about the Civil War, and even the Revolution. I've always felt a kind of intimate contact with the past. And of course, Daniel Boone was a great hero of my dad. I heard a lot about him when I was a kid. So I feel it was almost a natural thing for me to become interested in writing about that period. The immediate thing that took me back to the period was writing the novel Brave Enemies, set in the Revolution and culminating at the Battle of Cowpens.
How did writing about the American Revolution intersect with or lead you to Daniel Boone?
Well, Boone, of course, lived about 20 years in North Carolina on the Yadkin Valley, which was the far west at that time, hunting in the Blue Ridge and dealing with the Cherokees. He left North Carolina just before the Revolution. He left about 1772, 73, but he was very much involved in the Revolution. And as I worked on that novel set in the Revolution, I just thought more and more about the presence of the Indians, the conflict between the British and the Indians, the Americans and the British. I got more and more interested in trying to really see what it was like in western North Carolina and then in Kentucky in that period.
During that period. Well, I do want to explore that, or have you explore that in more detail later on. I've got a question in my mind, and you're just going to have to do a better job answering this question than I am asking it, but as you described your life growing up, plowing with a horse and without the complicated machinery and without television and kind of something close to subsistence, farming the way pioneers did it, with one foot in the 19th and one foot in the 21st century, but that foot back then was closer to being in the 19th century. So, I mean, what was your growing up life closer to what Daniel Boone's growing up life would have been in North Carolina in the 1770s to what a modern North Carolinian growing up in North Carolina in the tourist-ridden area near Hendersonville today would be?
Well, I feel my growing up was somewhere in between.
Well, what was what did you have that Boone didn't have?
Well, we had electricity was just coming in, and I had uncles who had pickup trucks who would take our beans to town, and we would ride the bus sometimes to town. My grandpa had a radio. I used to listen to the radio. He loved to listen to the Lone Ranger on it, and I would listen with him. My parents, though they didn't have a lot of formal education, were readers of books, and I had access to some books, particularly after the bookmobile started coming to Green River Church once a month, the Henderson County Bookmobile. That was when I was about 12 or 13, and after that I had access to books. Cousins then had television. But like Daniel Boone, I spent a lot of time hunting and fishing and tramping in the woods. I love to read about the Indians and think about the Indians. The fields where we worked had arrowheads in them. You get out hoeing corn and turn up an arrowhead or a piece of pottery. I felt, even as a kid, almost the shadow presence of Indians there. We knew the Cherokees had been there.
In that part of North Carolina, were there any, other than the physical remnants of Indians, were there other reminders of Indian cultures or any Indians themselves around?
Well, the Indian villages were mostly over the mountains on the Tuckasegee and the Little Tennessee River, over around there. The part of North Carolina I grew up in was Cherokee hunting country. And there were stories of fights between the ancestors, the settlers of that area, and the Indians, when they came and established temporary villages during the hunting season, I assume. But it was Cherokee territory up through the Revolutionary War. Some of the families where I grew up were part Indian. They had moved there and intermarried with Indians. And I think one of my ancestors had married the Indians, but I haven't... married an Indian, but I haven't been able to establish that. That certainly was the look in the family.
Uh-huh. But not able to claim casino money yet.
No money. Too far back. I think you have to be one quarter, right, to get in.
I'm not sure what the rules are about culture and bloodlines today. Talk about your... You mentioned that you were able to get access to books even outside your... home library when the bookmobile came about the time you were 11 or 12. At what point did you know that reading and maybe even writing were an important part of your life?
It was a gradual thing. I was always interested in writing, and the first story I ever wrote, I wrote in the sixth grade when I was studying with Mr. Ward. Dean Ward was the principal and my teacher, and the class took a field trip to the Biltmore House in the spring of, I guess it would be 1958, and cost $3 to go to the Biltmore House. I didn't have the $3, so I stayed in the classroom. Mr. Ward looked over at me sitting there, and he said, "I don't want you to waste the whole day. I know you love to read these books by Jack London and James Oliver Curwood, all these stories about the Mounties and the Yukon. Why don't you write a story?" So he gave me a plot. He said, "A man is lost in the Canadian Rockies. He doesn't have a gun, doesn't have a knife. Tell the story of how he gets back to civilization." So I spent that day working on that story, describing how he sharpened a stick on a rock and rubbed two sticks together to start a fire. I talked about how he... took a thorn and used it as a fish hook, that kind of thing. I really got into that story. By the time the other students came back from the Biltmore House, I had a story written. I think that was the first story I'd ever written. But in my teens, I was interested in all kinds of things. I wanted to study science. I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to go to West Point. I wanted to compose music. I just sort of tried everything. But it was reading Thomas Wolfe when I was 14, going on 15, that suggested to me that maybe I could be a writer. If Thomas Wolfe could grow up in Asheville and write a famous book, maybe I could write a book.
How old were you at this point?
I was 15 when I really became interested in writing and just started reading Hemingway and other writers.
Do you remember who put Thomas
Wolfe? The example of Thomas Wolfe. I knew he was famous and infamous.
Who put his book in your hand? Who put Look on Homeward Angel in your hands?
Got it from the bookmobile. Saw this big, big book in gray binding. It was the one with the gorse line illustrations. And I just fell in love with it. I, like most people, 15, decided, you know, Eugene Gant was me and his family was my family. And I was just intoxicated by that language. Oh, lost and by the wind, grieved, ghost, come back again. That sort of thing. And I discovered I was born on Thomas Wolfe's birthday, October 3rd. So I felt a real kinship with him.
Wow. Well, what, and then I guess that leads on to your, well, let me just say this. You mentioned that you didn't have the $3 to go to Biltmore House. Was the, your family's financial circumstances have other impacts on you as you were a junior high school and high school student?
Well, I don't think I was any more poor than most of the kids around, but my dad never made any money at farming. And he didn't like to work off on jobs. He could do just about anything, do carpentry, masonry, house painting. So we were often short of money, and they were building a house. My dad built a house, and whatever money we had went for materials for that. Sometimes my mother would work in the cotton mill for a while, and then she got a job as a beautician. Later, she got a job at the new GE plant there in Henderson County, and after that, we were a little more prosperous. There was regular money coming in, but money was tight. I, one year, had to work in the lunchroom for my lunch. I think that was when I was in the fifth grade, but it was a great adventure. I wouldn't have taken anything for that year of meeting the people and getting to work and getting to stay out of class to work in the lunchroom.
I wish we could. I want to come back and explore that piece of it, because you've taken two things that would seem to be tragedies in some kids' lives. First of all, having not to be able to go to the Biltmore House because you didn't have $3, and then having to work in the lunchroom and miss class in the fifth grade because you couldn't afford to buy lunch. Those would be detriments, and you describe them as being great adventures that you learned how to write.
Actually, they were. I'll tell you one of the best adventures of that job in the lunchroom was the state of North Carolina declared that everybody who worked in any sort of food establishment had to take a class in sanitation taught by somebody from Raleigh. And the woman who managed the lunchroom decided that literally meant everybody. So that the students who had, jobs there would have to go up to Hendersonville to the town hall and take this class in sanitation. Well, how do you get students, from school up to Hendersonville? We were about 8 miles away. The fellow who drove the bread truck every day, delivered bread to the lunchroom, agreed to take us kids uptown every morning at about 9 o'clock. So we got to ride in the bread truck. It was against the rules, so we had to sort of hide back among the racks of the bread until we got uptown, and he let us out at the town hall, and we went to this class, and of course everybody else was a manager of a cafeteria or a restaurant or something. We were the only kids there.
But a couple of fifth graders in with
and
a fancy
there
class.
There was that, and I can still remember how that fellow began his lecture. He said, last night I ate in a restaurant in Henderson County, and the waitress spat in my food. Then he went on to explain that she had licked her finger to turn the pages on her pad, her order pad, and perhaps some of that spit had gotten into the food. But then
Well, that'll be a line that will make its way into one of your books someday, or poems someday, if it hadn't already, if it hasn't already.
And then we got a ride back to Tuxedo. That was the school just before noon with the father of one of the students, and they had a big family. We would all crowd in this car and sing hymns going down to Tuxedo. it was just a lark. I had a great time.
Well, it's we got to take a break. I'm talking to Robert Morgan, a famous author of Gap Creek and other novels and poems, and now the author of Boone, a biography of Daniel Boone. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin.
Good to be here.
I'm visiting with Robert Morgan, who's the author of a new biography of Daniel Boone, which is coming out in October. We're talking about Daniel Boone's growing up and also about Robert Morgan's growing up. And Bob Morgan, before we begin to talk about Daniel Boone, I'd like to talk a little bit more about you, if that's okay.
Okay.
Leaving Henderson County in high school, what happened to you then? Did you follow in Thomas Wolfe's footsteps, or did you go on a different path?
Well, I wanted to get away where there were more books and music and that sort of thing. So without graduating from high school, I applied to an early admissions program at Emory University and was admitted, and had saved up enough money to go to Emory for a year to study primarily science. I had wanted to study some sort of science, but while I was at Emory, I discovered I was pretty good at mathematics. That was a great surprise to me. And I was at the top of the calculus class. I was put in an accelerated class for every...
So you had not even finished high school?
No, I never graduated. I don't have a high school diploma.
Would you finish the 11th grade or the 10th grade?
Yeah, I finished the 11th grade.
And you were able in your freshman year to go into calculus at Emory?
Right. They put me in this accelerated program where I took trigonometry and solid geometry and college algebra and beginning calculus all in one short quarter. And then I went on and took more advanced classes in calculus.
It doesn't sound to me like the standard preparation for writing poetry and fiction and biography.
Well, the inspiration was, we were supposed to beat the Russians. They had sent up Sputnik, and we were supposed to be engineers and mathematicians. So I transferred from Emory to NC State to study applied mathematics and aerospace engineering the next year. And that's what I was doing in 1962-63, having a wonderful time, actually, taking differential equations, advanced calculus, mechanics. But I almost by accident wandered into a class in creative writing at NC State taught by Guy Owen in the spring of 1963. And it was so wonderful. Guy was such a great teacher that I began to think less and less about mathematics and more about writing.
I want to for you to tell us, you just said you wandered into that class, and that's not the full story. What's the full story?
Well, I had planned to accelerate and take a very advanced class in partial differential equations. But my advisor looked at my records and he said, well, you never graduated from high school and you never made up some of the deficiencies because you never graduated from high school. Of course, I'd gone on and was taking much more advanced classes. He said, I'm not going to let you accelerate. And it was that opened up this spot on my schedule where I could take intro or creative writing with Guy Owen, English 222. I can still remember the number of it.
The number of the room or the number of the course?
That was the number of the course.
It was called writing or?
Over in Winston Hall there at NC State.
Well, another example of a crushing blow for many of us where you just think it's the greatest thing that ever happened to you in your life is that this.
Well, in the Baptist Church, we were taught about the blessing in disguise.
Well, do you believe that?
I've seen a lot of those. Oh, yeah. The thing that seems the setback at the time turns out to be the opportunity. I think most people discover that, don't they?
Tell us about Guy Owen as a teacher, and if he was as somebody who inspired you, and then what happened next?
Well, Guy was a wonderful teacher in so many ways. I mean, the first day of the class, he started talking about the use of language. He said, learn to be specific. Don't say tree, say oak tree, or better still, say post oak or chestnut oak. You know, what Henry James calls specification, right? The density of specification. And he said, listen to the way people talk. Learn the important inflections of speech so you can make your dialogue and your narration alive. Get the living language. I wrote a short story about based on the life of my great-grandmother, who could remember the Civil War.
Mm.
She had been taken to Walterboro, South Carolina, out of the mountains of North Carolina, which were overrun by outlaws, to be safe. And they were safe in Walterboro until Sherman came through. When he got to Savannah, he turned north. She could remember bodies being brought and piled up on the porch of their house. And the dogs climbing up on the bodies, that sort of thing. Well, I wrote this little story about her, and Guy Owen brought it into class and said, when I read this story, I wept.
Oh, my golly.
Nobody in calculus class
had ever wept at one of your solving an equation.
I was hooked. I mean, my vanity it was really stimulated by that, and I just began to think more and more about learning about writing and the other arts, and less about physics and mechanics and mathematics, and transferred to UNC Chapel Hill the next year.
And but you left Guy Owen behind?
Yeah, I had a wonderful writing teacher named Jesse Rader.
And what did you learn from Professor Rader?
Pardon me?
What did you learn from Rader?
Well, she was just completely encouraging, both in poetry and fiction. I was writing poems then. I began to write more and more poems, and she read everything and really encouraged me. One day I saw her in the parking lot. She was pulling out of the parking lot, and she stopped and rolled down her window and said, "You're the most talented student I have ever taught."
Mm.
Well, she may have said that to other students, for all I know, but it sure built up my my enthusiasm and dedication to writing.
Wow.
She was a great teacher.
Wow. Well, what else happened to you at Chapel Hill? Did you have the Thomas Wolfe type experience there, or did you have a more 20th century experience or 21st century experience?
Chapel Hill was just a wonderful place to be at that time. Everything was happening. The free speech movement, the civil rights movement, then the anti-war movement. But I just plunged in. I studied art history and went to see movies over at the Rialto in Durham, all these great Bergman movies and Antonioni and Fellini. I'd never seen a movie in a movie theater until I went off to college. My parents lived out in the country, and they wouldn't let me go to see movies. So I really began to make up for that in Raleigh and Chapel Hill and Durham. But probably the most important thing happened outside of the classroom. I had friends. I made friends there who were very interested in poetry and who knew a lot more about poetry than I did. They were mostly from the Northeast. They had gone to prep schools. They knew about French poetry. They could talk about metaphor and William Butler Yeats. And I just started talking to them and writing poems, and they really encouraged me. So that the poetry writing sort of overtook the fiction writing by the time I graduated.
Well, Robert Morgan, I've gotten so involved I've fallen behind in time. Let's take a quick break. Robert Morgan, author of poetry, of award-winning and best-selling fiction, now the author of a new biography about Daniel Boone, and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is Robert Morgan. author of Boone, a biography of Daniel Boone. Not quite out yet, I guess, but almost finished. Bob Morgan. You're almost finished with Boone.
We're just finishing editing the index as I speak.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing the completed product. I've gotten fascinated more with your life, and I'd like to continue talking about that just a little bit more, and maybe we'll talk about Daniel Boone later.
Okay.
When we took the break, you were at Carolina being inspired by Jesse Rader, your writing teacher, by movies, European movies at the Rialto in Durham, and by the familiarity with poetry of out-of-state students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel
right.
Hill.
And I was working on the Carolina Quarterly. I think I learned a good deal from that, too, reading manuscripts and seeing the other magazines. So I was just beginning to learn something about contemporary writing.
Did you know, at some point along the way, you did you begin to think of yourself as a writer, that writing would be your profession?
I think I did, yeah, with the encouragement of Jesse Rader and these other students who really were very encouraging. I remember giving a friend of mine named Dudley Carroll a sheaf of poems I had written, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody knocked on my door, and there he was holding the poems, and he said, "These are so good, I just had to come over and tell you."
Oh, well. So
that was really exciting because he knew a lot more about poetry than I did at that time. He had gone to, I think, Phillips Andover, and he knew how to talk about poetry, critique it. So I gradually wrote less fiction and more poetry in the mid-60s, and the poetry was reinforced. Looking back, it just seems amazing that I was publishing poems so young in national magazines. I was given a National Endowment for the Arts fellowship about 1967, I believe. I still was writing fiction at that time, but the poetry was being published and reprinted in anthologies, that sort of thing. And then I was hired by Cornell in 1971 as a poet.
Well, now what happened between Chapel Hill and Cornell?
I was given a fellowship to do graduate work, which I did in 1965-66 at Chapel Hill. I never finished that master's degree. I stayed home and wrote stories and poems for the most part. I may be the worst graduate student they have ever had at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm certainly in the running, I would think. I dropped out of graduate school and for almost a year worked with my dad as a house painter, continuing to write. Then I went back to school at UNC Greensboro and got a Master of Fine Arts degree.
And what did you learn, or who were your inspirers and teachers?
Well, my best teacher was Fred Chappell, who was just really a wonderful mentor. The best reader of poetry I think I have ever encountered to this day. Very tough teacher, but he's awfully good. And he encouraged me even more, I think, toward poetry. He was so enthusiastic about my poetry that by the time I actually graduated from that program, I was writing almost exclusively poetry. And something else that was very important at Chapel Hill was meeting Russell Banks and William Matthews.
How did that happen?
Well, I had met Russ in the fall of 64 when he came there. He was an older freshman coming back to school, but he had written a great deal. I already had an agent, as I recall. I got to know him, and he was in classes with Jesse Rader and Max Steele. Then I met William Matthews when he started graduate school in 1965. They started a magazine called Lilla Bolero, and I think they published my poems in almost every issue.
Well,
published my first book of poems in 1969, a book called Zirconia Poems.
And how did...
But through Matthews and Banks, I really got in touch with the contemporary world of poetry.
How does a poet, even a good poet, get his poetry published? And in this case, how did you get your first book of poetry published?
Well, I was lucky in that my first publications were in a magazine called the Southern Poetry Review, edited by Guy Owen, my friend and former teacher, in the Carolina Quarterly, also edited by friends, and Lilla Bolero, and the Greensboro Review. So I was publishing first in magazines in the region, but I began to send poems out to places like The Nation and American Scholar, and was publishing in National Magazine by 1968, 69.
So with a repertoire of credible, variety of credible publications publishing your poetry, a publisher of poetry would have a good case that you
Well, it's very different from publishing fiction, which is a much more commercial kind of thing. Poets all know each other, mostly work through their connections. I mean, somebody knows somebody. That first book was published by Russell Banks and William Matthews in 1969. They'd already moved back up north. They were no longer in Chapel Hill. And editors saw that, and I would get letters from editors saying, "Oh, I just read your book. Would you send me some poems?" I've always been very lucky that way.
What
editors would ask me for poems. They still do, as a matter of fact. My second book was published by Norton. I met the editor at Norton at Cornell after I came to Cornell in 1971. He said, "Well, I've read some of your poems. Would you send me a book?"
Wow.
You can't beat that, yeah.
Well, now, did you get rich on the royalties from your poetry book?
I did not. I think poetry cost me more than it ever repaid, except I got a teaching job, and I've won several grants, National Endowment for the Arts, Rockefeller, Guggenheim. But the royalties from poetry are minimal.
The
only poem that ever made me any money was a little poem called Honey, which was published in the Atlantic Monthly, I think, in 1991, and then it was picked up by the Best American Poetry, and then Garrison Keillor read it on his show, and I got several hundred dollars from that. But in 1998, a woman in Vancouver asked if she could buy the film rights
to a poem?
That poem. And I said, "You sure can." And she ended up giving me, I think, about $3,800 Canadian dollars for the film rights. She made a little experimental movie financed by the Canadian Film Board.
Well,
so there is money in poetry after all.
Well, let's take a quick break, Robert Morgan, and then come back and talk a little bit about how poetry turned back to fiction. Robert Morgan, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm visiting with Robert Morgan, who's the author of an upcoming new biography of Daniel Boone. And Bob Morgan, you've been kind enough to sort of take us along the pathway, your pathway, not towards the hunting grounds of Kentucky like Daniel Boone, but towards the hunting grounds of writing award-winning and commercially successful fiction. I'm going to have to hurry you a little bit, or we'll be done, but all of this success in poetry led to a position at Cornell, and how did that happen?
I gave a reading at Cornell in the fall of 1970. I was invited by William Matthews, who was my publisher. They had published Zirconia Poems the year before that. And it must have gone well, because the next spring I came home from my house painting job in Hendersonville, North Carolina, one day, and there was a letter inviting me to come and teach poetry workshops at Cornell for a year. The chairman said, "Don't expect to stay at Cornell. It's just a visiting job for one year." I did come to Ithaca, brought my family here, and really have been here ever since. that year led to another visiting appointment, and then I was made a professor in 1973.
Well, your teaching and presence at Cornell over these, what, almost 30 years? Or
36 years.
36 years. But your writing is poetry, your novels primarily have a Southern, a North Carolina connection. How do you, are you a Southern writer? Are you a North Carolina writer? Or are you a national writer who looks back at his...
Well, I certainly think of myself as a North Carolina writer. Almost all my writing is set in either the mountains of North Carolina or South Carolina. I want to write about upstate New York, but first I've got to tell all these stories from North Carolina. There's just so many of them, I haven't been able to work through the whole thing. But I tell people that I came from Southern Appalachia and I moved to Northern Appalachia.
Yeah.
Part of New York State is not all that different from Western North Carolina. The mountains, the ridges look similar, and I think that the people are kind of similar. So.
Well, what are the differences?
Well, the differences right now have to do with the fact that the Southern Appalachians are developing so fast with retirees and tourism that's a lot busier world than the Finger Lakes of New York, which is still more country, and real estate is more reasonable up here, that sort of thing. The traffic is not as bad, but of course there are deep differences. The great difference between the culture of the North and South is the Civil War and the memory of the Civil War of it. That I and most of the people I knew in North Carolina have ancestors who fought with the Confederacy. It's just a different set of memories, a different way of relating to American culture. There are more similarities than differences, but that's certainly the great difference, I think.
Well, some people, John Sheldon Reed reminds here in Chapel Hill reminds me that he didn't really understand what it was to be a Southern until he left the region and looked back at it. Do you have a different kind of insight about North Carolina and the South that informs your writing than you would have had you remained here? Do you sense that, or is that, or how do you feel about that?
Well, after I moved to Ithaca, New York, I began to think more and more about the Southern Appalachians. And I really became a student of the mountains in a way I never had been when I lived there. I started going to the Cornell Library and checking out books of county history, regional history, histories of the Cherokee Indians, studies of the dialect of the Southern Appalachians. I became a student of the region up here much more than I had been there. And obviously the distance perhaps gives you another perspective, perhaps a kind of objectivity. So many writers about the South have lived out of the South. Have you noticed that? People like Robert Penn Warren, Thomas Wolfe. I think it's directly influenced me to maybe write more about the past. There are writers who know more about the contemporary South than I do, because I have lived away from it. But my focus has been earlier in the 20th century and even in the 19th century and even the 18th century. But I know that I became more self-consciously Southern and Southern Appalachian once I left the region. So I think Reed is right about that.
How did your, at Cornell, how did you get back into writing a narrative, fiction, and now biography, and I don't want to say away from poetry, but in addition to poetry?
Well, throughout the 70s, I just lived and breathed poetry. I taught it, I read it, I wrote about it, I wrote it. But around 1980, I knew that I had to get back to fiction writing because I wanted to tell stories, and I wanted to write in voices other than my own. And I had not been able to do that in poetry. Now, some people probably could, but I had not. I wanted to tell those stories I had heard about the Revolution and about the family, about the Panthers, and about the Civil War. So I started writing prose again. But it took me a long time to really get back into the mode of storytelling. I had to really get away from the poetry. I told myself that I will strip down language. I will not write poetic prose. I will write stories of action and character. It took about 6 years, about 1986, before I wrote a story good enough to publish, really. I say if there's hope for me, there's hope for anybody. It took me a long time, but that was the reason. I wanted to tell stories, and I wanted to write in voices other than my own.
Wow.
And once I learned to let my characters tell their own story, and particularly when I learned that I could write in the voice of a woman character, and that was in 1989 when I was writing the novella The Mountains Won't Remember Us, that's my great breakthrough as a writer. It's the most important thing that ever happened to me as a writer was to learn that you let your characters tell the story, and that by concentrating, I could write in the voice of a woman character.
Wow.
That just seemed daunting. It seemed impossible to me before that.
Well, it's still a magnificent achievement. You know, we've run out of time, Robert Morgan, and have only begun your story, and we haven't gotten into Boone, so I'm going to have to ask you if you'll come back another day and visit with us.
Okay, I'll be happy to.
Our guest has been Robert Morgan, author of a new biography of Daniel Boone. And he'll be back with us soon. Thanks to all y'all for listening.